We're going to talk a little bit about content operations.
Ooh. Get me another drink.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, give me four or five drinks.
Hello and welcome to episode 212 of the Rockstar CMO Epic Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday the 6th of April. Hope you're well and staying as sane as you feel you need to be. I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm not a rock star, but I am a CMO and trusted marketing advisor. And on this podcast, with the help of my chums, we share marketing street knowledge to inspire your inner rock star. Come say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com or on LinkedIn at rockstarcmo. And we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. This week in the marketing studio, Jeff Clark and I have a chat about all this noise around the death of the CMO. And in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar, Robert Rose has a thought about content operations over a splendid sounding cocktail. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Right, let's get this show on the road and join our resident strategy advisor, former Forrester Research Director, Jeff Clark, in our marketing studio.
And welcome to the Rockstar CMO Studio.
How are you, my friend?
Thank you. How are you? I am doing well. What's interesting, and I don't want to jump right into the weather, but back in February when we were having April like weather, my wife said, in April we're going to have February like weather, and Lo and behold, we're having a snowstorm here on April 4th.
Wow. I once went to, when was this? Years ago. We went to Boston for Easter weekend, which is the weekend we just had. I guess it was a later Easter because when we went, it was 80 degrees when we were there at the weekend. And just the week before, they'd had 2 feet of snow. Yeah. Just like crazy. So yeah, up that way where you is can be a bit unpredictable. Yeah, it can be a bit unpredictable. Yep. So did you have a lot of snow or just a flurry?
Well, we were supposed to, this is the thing, is that in which if you get something in April, it's like it fluctuates and they say, we're going to get a foot of snow. And then it's like, oh, we're going to get a couple inches. And then it goes back and forth and back and forth, depending on where you are on in the storms lines. And so we're just getting a couple inches, but it does brighten things up a bit. Although we have my wife had to cover some of the daffodils and things to make sure that we're going to get trounced.
Yeah, it's hell for gardeners, isn't it? Like here, if we have a late frost or something like that. The weird thing is this year, and I don't think we ever get snow in April, but this year we've had hardly any snow. We haven't had any snow that fell and held over the winter. Had a lot of rain. It's been a very wet winter, but not very snowy. So anyway, So did you have a nice Easter weekend?
Yes, it did.
It's someone who's celebrates.
Yeah, and our daughter was here for up till then, and it was nice. How about yourself?
Oh yes, we do the old chocolate and hot cross buns. We're very devout Easter people we are. so very a nice to have a long weekend. Although of course. I was chatting to a CMO that I'd coach or mentor or whatever you call the advice that I give him. And we were both like, yeah, but it just means we've got a short week. Now we've got to do 5 days working 4 days. So holidays are all very well, but yes.
Yeah. It just always amazes me because having dealt with colleagues across the water in Europe, it's like you guys take Easter Monday, Easter Friday, or, you know, Good Friday.
Yeah.
And for us, it's like, yeah, Easter happens. If you go to church, you go to church.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's working 24/7 anyway. So,
well, we don't get, I mean, yes, we do get more. But Europe does get more holidays than you do. But so I'm not even.
Well, the thing is, people take them.
All right, so almost on the topic of extended holidays, this one, isn't it? So this week, we are going to talk about the supposed, and I'm caveating that, demise of the CMO. I know we kind of touched on it last week. You are inspired, or you have brought to the attention of the Rockstar CMO Studio an article in the Fortune magazine. It's actually by Phil Waber. Well, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And that explores the exit of several notable CMOs, a place like UPS, Etsy, and Walgreens. And it went on to suggest that these departures and the subsequent removal of the CMO role at these companies was evidence of the fading of marketing's prominence as an autonomous C-suite discipline. And this seems to be like a pop. I mean, same with, we'll touch on tenure. It seems like a popular trope at the moment about the death of the CMO. But obviously, there are other opinions out there. And to offer a counter opinion, in Marketing Week just shortly after that, Mark Ritson, the famous potty mouth marketing professor, disagrees. He referred to a conflicting opinion in a Forbes article that quoted some research from Boathouse Inc. And I'll include links to all of these things I'm referring to here in the show notes. And he said, if we wanted evidence of the inherent horse shittery in Tuesday's Fortune, the claims that that actually CEOs are apparently gaining a new confidence in their chief marketing officers and everything looks rosy for marketers and marketing on the top floor. What say you, Jeff? Who do you agree with?
I say that that's clickbait. I say, and I'm going to apologize for my cynicism here, but I think that partially it's an unfortunate effort to get people to read content, you know, boost their advertising revenue, create fear and uncertainty among our marketing leadership, and then, you know, that leads people to go, geez, I wonder what other people think. I might as well, I'll look at Mark Ritson. I'll look at Forbes. So thereby increasing ad revenues all around.
So just to be clear, you're saying the Fortune magazine is clickbait.
Correct.
This whole death of the CMO, just because these three brands let their CMOs go, is not.
It's putting something out there that's controversial, makes people think and makes people, you know, dig deeper. It is one thing just to note is that, you know, they mention a lot of CMOs leaving from big organizations. It is more anecdotal, whereas the Forbes article is based on research. So,
right, that's,
I'll give the Forbes people credit for that. But
just about Forbes, I hate giving links to people for Forbes articles because when you go on Forbes, you get bombarded by ads, don't you? It's a dreadful reading experience. But in this case, it might be worth trudging through the ads to get to this content on that Forbes article. Right. Anyway, carry on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the thing that what caught my attention about the article was the fact that I know that there was a Boston area CMO networking event where they were actually putting this as the topic of discussion. And so most of those folks, you know, seem pretty secure in their roles. I think that they're not worried about their own particular careers in this case, but it's like, well, if they're talking about it, we should probably dig into this see if this controversial trend seems to, you know, have any meat to it and what we think about it.
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, we do research for this show. I know it doesn't come across that maybe I don't, based on that published I started looking into this, and there are a number of big brands that got rid of the role of CMO a few years ago, and then they've got CMOs back again. It seems to be like it's a revolving thing with some of these organizations. But what I did notice was a lot of this discussion is with these big brands of B2C that obviously get the attention of somebody like Fortune magazine. But so is this relevant in B2B? And I don't actually know why I'm asking this question now, because you're like, well, is it relevant at all? Like whether it's relevant in B2B.
Yeah, really.
But do you think this is relevant in B2B?
Well, I think it is. That's the right question to ask because the organizational structures are going to be very different B2B and B2C. Well, they're different industry to industry, you know, for that matter. But the Fortune article, I mean, you know, mentions other, you know, Lowe's, Hyatt, hotels, McDonald's, Johnson & Johnson, Uber, Lyft. I mean, these are big names. So it's like if the CMO is somehow now missing from the leadership of the organization, then that's something. This is something to say. Where else is this trend going to make its way, and is it going to affect us? And one of the things that I thought was interesting in the Fortune article, it gives a reason, and not necessarily the reason, but it does say that there's a growing number of CEOs who come up from the marketing side of the business. So therefore, they're bringing their own skills. You know, they're guarding marketing from the top post. You know, it's kind of like they're a player coach, we would say, in sports. So that's, you know, that's, they did say that 10% CEOs have marketing experience, which is higher than years ago. I'm not sure we would see that trend in B2B.
Yeah. So. No, I agree with you on that one. And sorry, I was jumping in there because I think this is an interesting topic because, again, if there's three things we know about marketing in the C-suite, one is, and we'll touch on tenure in a minute because that's the popular topic, isn't it? It's like we've got the attention span of goldfish and CMOs have got short tenure. It's the two truths of the world. The other one is this idea that CMOs are going away with some of these big brands. And the other one is that, you know, that the top job a marketer can get in a biz is CMO. There's nowhere after that. The CEOs don't tend to come from marketing, do they? They come from sales, finance, operations, as you point out, particularly in
business, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's certainly my experience is they do come up from, you know, I don't know, I guess you would say the more naturally business savvy divisions within an organization, sales, finance, operations, product development, maybe less so because, you know, I mean, depending on the company, because a lot of tech firms, you know, It's the founder, the guy that came up with the brilliant idea that makes his way to the top.
That's typically short-lived, isn't it? Because you need a professional CEO. And I mean, even though I am a marketer and a CMO, I can certainly respect that because it's a commercial role, isn't it? Being the CEO is, and so somebody should have that commercial and financial background to be the CEO. But talking about roles there, so what roles are we seeing are replacing the CMO? I mean, because we're seeing things like CRO and CRO chief revenue officer, and we're seeing CCO chief commercial officer. And actually, I know that we were going to sort of, I'm going to mention Grant, our old boss here on this one, actually, and that we didn't discuss this before, because in one of his posts where he's talking about what you should look for in a new CMO role is if you're reporting to the CRO or the CCO, is it really a CMO role? Do you know what I mean? So that's where I've kind of got this idea from, is if the CMO role is diminishing, even if it's called CMO, if you report to the CCO or the CRO, are you still a CMO?
That is an excellent point in that. And I don't want to go too out of order of our short show notes, but there's a LinkedIn blog that you will refer to. I can't remember the name of the guy who put it up, his Mark Shoki.
Oh, right.
Anyway, he noted, because you know, in this LinkedIn blog, which it's not a research-based blog, but it's kind of along the same theme in that he noted that, you know, when you're looking at CMO roles that are posted and you see what they're asked to do, like he noted a role that says the CMO has to understand Google Analytics, SEM, website keywords. Yeah. Growing online communities, coordinate with PR firms, email funneling and retargeting, user acquisition, branding and content strategy. Now, with the exception of probably the word branding, I'd say these are all very tactical, and this is not a CMO profile. Yeah. So, you know, that's one of those things. It's like when you see that, you know, Mark Ritson says, you know, what you should do is you should lie during the recruitment process, get the job, and then tell them what a marketing leader really should be doing. I know that's a risky strategy, but one of the things that
because I'm working with a startup, and I do think that we as marketers need to be able to roll up our sleeves and understand those concepts. I think understanding those concepts is fine, but doing the work is not. It's not our sort of senior CMO role at that point, is it? I think it's the point you're making.
Yeah. What one of the things that I thought was interesting is that from the, again, this goes back to the Fortune article, is that they said with the rise of MarTech, that we're creating customer touch points that go beyond marketing. So historically, you know, CMOs dealt with marketing and advertising like those in print and TV ads. This is, again, showing their business to consumer roots here. But tech has disguised that role, transforming it into one that is more algorithmically driven, full of customer insights, and so mission critical, and is so mission critical that it falls under C-suite executives' remit, which I think is an interesting point, because I know when the whole topic of managing customer experience got hot back, I don't know, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, is that, you know, CMOs kind of struggled because they didn't come up through this necessarily very tech-oriented, very sort of customer, I don't know, it's like you've got aspects of sales, customer service, and other, you know, other functions. And so, you know, some CMOs were like, you know, guns hold about, you know, sort of being the customer experience leaders. Others were not, or maybe they didn't have the capabilities. And so then, You see companies hire customer experience, you know, executives, and it's like, well, now you're actually taking a little bit of what marketing could help manage.
I think and you're put making
to somebody else.
But I think you're making a much better point than the Fortune article does, because I think that what the thing they stated there, that tech has digitized the role and therefore made it more algorithmic, and it's beyond customer touch point, additional customer touch point, so therefore it sits under other C-suite executives. That's complete bollocks as far as I'm concerned, right? What I think your point about customer experience and that somebody owning the customer experience makes more sense. That is nothing to do with the technology or anything like that, is it?
Absolutely.
It's just an understanding of the discipline of the customers need love too, right? And if your marketing team aren't going to provide that, we need a champion of the customer at the C-suite, which is fair enough, right? And sometimes that's offered up by a head of customer care, or it might be headed up by the CRO, or it might be the CMO, right? So I think that's a very different point. I think you make a much better point there than the bloody article does.
I should be writing for Fortune, which is fine if I can get the job. Yeah. The other pressure, which we've talked about before in the show, is the advent of a chief revenue officer.
Yeah.
So, you know, somebody who probably most likely has sales as their primary remit, but they've decided for whatever reason to tuck marketing under that. And, you know, and I think in some markets that makes sense. In some markets it doesn't. In the sort of technology market we're familiar with, that didn't seem to work very well. Oftentimes this is due to, as opposed to being the right functional structure, this is more due to the personalities, the strengths of the leadership. Something's fluid, you know, we lost a CMO, we don't have the money to hire a CMO, let's just roll it under the CR, you know.
Yeah.
These things are always fluid, and so it's hard without the data, which, thank God, the Forbes article, you know, did a lot of referencing to data. Without the data, it's hard to really get to, you know, beyond the anecdotes to say what the real trends are.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that's an excellent point as well, because I chatted with a CMO last year, who his name is now escaped me. But one of the things that came through from that interview was the tight relationship he had with the CRO, that there's a complete partnership there between marketing and sales. And I think that sometimes when that, you know, the CEO gets frustrated with that partnership, he just puts a head on top to sort of bang their heads together as sales and marketing, because he can't be bothered to deal with it anymore. And a startup I'm working for, they have a CCO or CRO, and because I'm helping them, he's like, well, you know, I don't need to worry about this marketing shit anymore because you're here. So, and I think that can, like you're saying, that dynamic can change depending on the abilities you've got across the team.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's the roles that are changing. So I think we're fairly much debunking everything we're reading here, aren't we? So if there's not the demise. So we might as well. I mean, let's go ride another one of the fucking hobby horses about the future of the CMO. So if the CMO's not, there's no demise of the CMO, what about all this talk about the reduced tenure of the CMO? What's your view on that? Oh, so the other thing, sorry, and there's another reference in here, isn't there, that I should, because we then dug into that Forbes article on the Boathouse Research, and weirdly enough, they were seeing the short tenure as a positive thing, that CEOs are now view short CMO tenure as an indicator of success, whereas their previous research said that short tenure was a sign of failure, which completely fucking confused me, because I'm like, yeah.
Sorry, I hope they double check the data to see whether there was an aberration. Either this year was an aberration or last year was an aberration, or whether it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, I'm not sure what to make of that change in the stats, because, you know, I think in our line of work, you know, CMOs don't appear, and I should say, when I mean our line of work, I mean like the markets we've been working in, is the CMOs don't appear to last as long as other senior executives in sales, product, finance. You know, but perhaps because I've also seen, you know, like in services or support or operations, you know, those are also people that may not, you know, have long tenure. And if you think about somebody's come in to fix something, you know, when you hire somebody, if it's just, you know, purely a replacement because somebody retired or something, it's like you're coming in because you're going to fix something. So you're going to fix the brand. You're going to fix the focus on demand. Maybe the team dynamics are bad. Mm-hmm. You got to reduce costs. You know, I want to bring somebody in who like really slims things down and, you know, and make sure things are efficient. And so if you fix it, you know, if you came in to fix that brand thing, maybe you're not the right person for the next challenge.
Yeah.
And so then maybe you're out, and maybe you want to go on to something else. I mean, I knew a guy who I worked with a long time ago, but he went on to roles in Cisco and other big companies.
Yeah.
And it's like he had a thing that he did, and a lot of it was around aligning marketing and selling, driving demand. You know, be just working in concert with the sales team. So it's kind of like you get that thing, you get that engine running. Okay, now the next problem is brand or whatever else. So you may not be the best person for that. And then, of course, if you don't fix it, you're out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So it's so it is something that maybe by nature, CMOs are not a, you know, they're not going to have like a 10, 20 year tenure in that role, like I've seen CFOs or, you know, chief product people.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I think that it's almost like I was going to say it's like a seasonal thing, or it's like the ebb and flow. It's actually that, you know, that area of the business is where you're most likely to see change. I mean, they're never going to change the rules of how you calculate EBITDA, right? So if the CFO can count and gets on well with the CEO and does all the things, why change? You know, you're not going to change your CFO. But like you're saying, you know, different, you know, companies go through different phases. They have different pressures. They have different goals at that particular time. And some CMOs are better at dealing with the up times, and some are better at dealing with the downside, or whatever is changing the business, isn't it? So I guess that's part of that, isn't it? It's that's where that flex happens.
Yeah.
So we always give first, we always try and give some advice to people who are concerned about these things, even though we've just said, well, I don't think we should worry. But anyway, especially B2B. So what would B2B CMOs need to do to make sure they're not part of these statistics?
Well, you know, in the Forbes survey, or which was done by this group called Boathouse, and they talked about giving good ratings to their marketing departments and to the CMOs themselves, is that behind the reversal was CMO saying that the CMOs are delivering on core business priorities. But I'm having the pronunciation problem you had at the beginning. So nearly 9 in 10 CEOs believe their CMO understands and takes action on their vision. So they're going way up. The score is going up in terms of driving growth, innovation, analytics, in areas that the CMO or CEO values most. So I, you know, it's if you go in and you realize, because this was another thing in the survey, CEOs want marketing to solve 5 core business problems: drive revenue, sales and market share, differentiate from competitors, improve brand and reputation, and transform the company narrative. So, you know, this is where you get into one of our 5 fundamentals of marketing.
Yeah.
I should say 5 effing fundamentals, which is creating the master plan. That's the first fundamental, because, you know, you want to have a role in, one, developing corporate strategy to the extent that you can. And then you have the role in aligning your team with the business objectives, priorities, and goals that help marketing actually execute on that business, or help the business execute on that strategy. So, you know, this is where 40% of CEOs gave CMOs an A grade in terms of their trust in the C-suite. You know, and that's due to good alignment and communications and making sure you're focused on the right things. And I think that's one thing where, if we went back to, you referenced our friend Grant Johnson, I mean, that's one of the things he was always adamant about making sure he did as soon as he got into a new role.
Yeah, yeah. I think that we are going to have a list of about 10 things we need to link to in the show notes with all the things that we've heard. And in fact, maybe we should do a little bit of coverage of that Boathouse survey and maybe publish a blog post on it, because it is quite, we'll include a link to it, listeners, if you want to have a look at that, because there is some positivity there in CMOs, particularly when we hear so much doom and gloom, don't we, around that stuff.
And I think this is a topic that we'll come back to, because, I mean, we've hit like 3 or 4 questions that popped up from this, but there will be other questions that... Yeah. As the surveys and the data evolves in time.
Excellent. And yes, and just to summarize what you're just saying, if we align with the goals of the business, then we shouldn't have any problems whatsoever. So do your effing master plan. yeah. And also, I did mention at the beginning that we actually stuck to our editorial policy of, that was 5 questions for anybody that was counting. So we've done our 5 questions on this topic, our 5 things. What song are we going to play out with today?
We're going to play out on Do I Want to Know by Arctic Monkeys in 2013. Mm-hmm. They say, do I want to know if this feeling flows both ways? Sad to see you go. Sort of hoping that you'd stay. I think that kind of sums up.
If you don't
stick to marketing fundamental number 1.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to be feeling.
Exactly. All right, so I'll play out with that. And I'm not going to see you for about 4 weeks, right, Jeff?
Or 3. I'll be out of commission for 3 weeks, so yeah. I wouldn't like to get back on the schedule.
Yeah. Ended. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to say goodbye to Jeff for a few weeks while you take some travel to Europe, I believe.
Yes, to the land of Norway.
Nice. Well, I hope it's not snowing there.
Probably will be.
All right,
follow the snow all the way up to the Arctic Circle.
All right, mate. Well, I'll see you in a few weeks. And for the listeners, I'll include links to all the things we just discussed in the show notes. And I'll play out with Do I Want to Know by the Arctic Monkeys. Yeah, see you soon, buddy.
Cheers.
Cheers. Have you got color in your cheeks? Do you ever get that feel that you can't shift the tide that sticks around like summer in your teeth? Are there some aces up your sleeve? Have you no idea that you're in deep? I dreamt about you nearly every night this week. How many secrets can you keep? 'Cause there's this tune I found that makes me think of you somehow, and I play it on repeat until I fall asleep, spilling drinks on my settee. I wanna know if this feeling flows both ways.
Thank you, Jeff. That was a tiny bit of the Arctic Monkeys and Do I Want to Know, and a lot of stuff to link to in there, which of course I will include in the show notes. And we say cheerio to Jeff for a few weeks, but in the meantime, if you have a topic you would like us to pick up when he gets back, please get in touch. You can find us on LinkedIn or through our website, rockstarcmo.com. Right, it's that time of the week to wind down in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and join the chief troublemaker at the content advisory, Robert Rose, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Well, hello, my friend, and welcome to the bar. A busy week, a busy week indeed. And yes, I am just coming off the road.
Yes.
And so I have a wonderful drink for us, a fancy cocktail for us this week here in the weekend bar. And it is called a Cloverleaf. It is a gin drink, which it bodes well for you. And so it is called a Cloverleaf. And it is, it's a little more tricky to make this, but you'll like it. And the reason I got inspired because, so when I was a kid, and when I say kid, I mean of drinking age, but still a kid. and I used to drink my favorite cocktail. This is going to sound so gross. And it was, and it is, this cocktail that was made up of Chambord. You know Chambord liqueur,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you know the
yeah.
okay. Yeah, it's basically fruit juice that has alcohol in it.
Yeah.
fancy name for fruit juice with alcohol, Chambord. It's a liqueur, and I used to have Chambord liqueur with vodka and orange juice, and it made this like I don't know quasi fruit punch. That as a kid, I loved that drink. It was my favorite cocktail. And I actually had one about a week and a half ago, and I was like, this is the nastiest thing I've ever put in my mouth.
Teeth fell out.
I can't, yeah, I can't believe that I actually used to drink this. But I actually did enjoy the taste of the Chambord. So I was like, oh, is there anything that actually uses Chambord that would actually be, you know, pleasurable? So this is what I found. And it is, like I said, it's called the Cloverleaf. And it has, so you have a half part of Chambord liqueur, or you can use, if you don't want the liqueur, you can do a grenadine of some kind.
Yeah.
But basically a half part of that, and then 1.5 parts of gin. So you end up with sort of 2 parts alcohol, right? 1.5 ounces of gin, and then a half part of Chambord, and then a little bit of lemon juice. And then here's the tricky part. You have to have the egg whites. This is, you know, sort of an egg white drink where you sort of, you know, froth up the egg whites. And then you're going to add a mint leaf here. So basically you combine the Chambord and the gin and the lemon juice and the egg whites into a cocktail shaker with ice cubes. And then you shake that up and you got to shake it really hard so that because you want those, those egg whites to froth up and get really frothy. And then you strain all of that into... a martini glass or your favorite, you know, wonderful shaped cocktail glass. And you want to make sure that there's that thin layer of foam at the top and all of that. And then garnish that with a mint leaf and you have your clover leaf. And it's absolutely delightful.
Yeah, nice. I remember making one of your suggested cocktails that had egg whites in it. Is it like a whiskey sour or something like that? And with the shaking.
Yes, exactly.
Oh yes, that's great. I've not done that.
Yeah, the
before.
Egg whites can be a little tricky. You know, it can be a little tricky, and especially in the shaking part because it's like it can just get messy and ucky. But yeah, if it's, when it's done well, it's
you got to give
it. Just takes a little bit of practice.
Yeah, you got to give it the beans, haven't you? You really got to shake it. Yes.
Yeah, you got to shake it. Yeah, shake vigorously. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah,
lovely. And where would we be drinking these clover leaves?
I think we need someplace really super cosmopolitan for this.
Yeah.
I'm thinking we're either in, you know, in the middle of London somewhere or Paris or maybe Berlin, somewhere really super cosmopolitan and modern. And, you know, maybe we've just gone to an art museum with some modern art.
Love it.
And all of that. And it's sort of the after the museum cocktail. It's very fancy and very, you know, refined, as it were.
Yeah. I think I like the idea of Paris. There's a hotel that's got a bar right at the top, and you sort of look over.
It is
Paris.
A very French drink. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that sounds great. And, so we're looking over this beautiful scene in our cosmopolitan city, and conversation, as it always does with us, turns to marketing. What are we talking about this week, mate?
We're going to talk a little bit about content operations.
Ooh, get me another drink.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, give me 4 or 5 drinks. It's interesting. There was a recent research study that came out, and we started to see this. It sort of validates what we've sort of felt for the last 6 months or a year or even 2 years, is that basically using our employees as content creators and influencers. This is especially true in B2B, by the way. That using our employees as content creators and influencers is a huge value. And in fact, is sort of leaning into something that's already happening and it's just trying to harness that, right? And, you know, there are, the thing is, you go, oh, we want to have employees post up social media content. We want to have employees create content. We want to have employees do videos. We want to have them on TikTok and basically helping us evangelize our brand. And that giant like shuddering sound you just heard was everybody in marketing going, are you kidding me? We're going to let these people just like run rampant and create content? No, thank you very much. You know, they worry consistency and tone and story and quality and all the things that put content and communications at risk when you sort of let everybody do stuff. But it's an absolute mandate these days. And so the thing you have to think about is not if or when it's going to happen, but how you're going to harness it when it happens, right? And so that's the new role of the content team these days. And what it made me think of was, it's, you know, again, another lesson that we can learn from Hollywood is that it's a little bit like the content team is changing its role from skill player, you know, actor, writer, you know, musician, into the director's job, right? Into the director's chair. And it's thinking like a movie director thinks. And if you think about it, if, you know, for movies, you know, the director really participates the least in the direct creative work that you see on the screen, right? Because the director's role isn't to write, it's not to act, it's not to play music, or, you know, even point the camera. The director's job is typically to enable all of those individual artists to come together in one particular direction, right? And I know there are directors who do double duty, you know, that they act, they, you know, they're writer directors or actor directors or even cinematographer directors. But basically, the director function on a movie is the basically to guide, enable, and manage the team of other storytellers to all move in the same direction to tell a powerful story and create a great work. And so, in a great film, if you think about it, the words, the pictures, the actors, the costumes, they mesh so completely that removing any of them would basically pull the piece apart and make it much less than it was. And really great transcendent directors do this so successfully that they actually have a signature style. You know, think Martin Scorsese or, you know, Quentin Tarantino or any of those kinds of things. So that's the talent of a director, right? That's what the talent and the skill set needs to be of today's modern content team. They should be embracing that director role. And I'll give you an example of this. So the company's content leader at this company that I was working with a couple of months ago had basically created this internal content studio, right? They called it a content studio, and they would create all manner of marketing things and content thought leadership things. And basically, they'd earned enough respect that they were sort of the go-to team when the company needed content and design, like an internal, you know, design agency almost, right? You know, that's where you go to get pretty words and pictures done. And the problem is that achievement also comes with now a frustrating new responsibility is you're now the sole provider of all the things, right? So more and more people saw them as like this bottleneck preventing the release of more content because they can only work so fast and they only have so many headcount. And the content leader that was talking to me was saying, I want my team to play a more important role and a strategic role, but this landslide of requests is actually turning us more into a commoditized machine than it is actually a strategic thing. It's sort of the problem with being so good that we're now churning out more unremarkable content because there's more demand for it. And so the key is that she had to change the team's charter and remit to not just be a provider of cool, interesting things, content assets, but rather to scale into being a director, to enabling the rest of the organization to be good at content. And what I've done is I've basically created this framework that we've used a few times with clients, and I won't go through it here. We can point to a link here, but basically, there are six responsibilities that a new content team has to take on, and there are a couple of really important ones. And so they are strategy, which is basically coming up with the planning and prioritization, right? Mm-hmm. So just like a movie director, they work with all the department heads to create a charter and a purpose for the production, for the movie, how it's all going to work, who's going to make decisions about what, how they're going to, you know, what they're going to do first, what they're going to do second. They get, you know, so they're basically herding all the production and cross-functional areas first. Mm-hmm. Then two, all the raw creation of content and management of all those content assets. Just like a movie director, first thing a movie director does is storyboard out the entire movie and then basically figure out all the existing content that they're going to need, that, you know, B-roll and establishing shots. And they might not even be there for that. They'd have a whole team going off and doing, you know, B-roll and establishing shots and music and all sorts of things that are going to play an important role in the movie, but they're not even there when it gets created. But basically, they map it all out, of course. Then three is actually producing all that stuff, basically taking all those raw elements and putting them together and being really good at making it all organized through. And there are plenty of technologies that do this for, you know, movie directors, to, you know, asset management systems and all those things. Then once all those things are ready to go, publishing and promoting that idea. You know, directors play a huge role in the marketing of films, building the trailer, building all those kinds of things. And then ultimately measurement and insight and improvement, where they actually see what they did so that they can actually, you know, make the TV show or, you know, take it on the road or whatever they're going to do. So it's looking at those six responsibilities. And like I said, I go into much more detail in a post, and actually assuming those directing level responsibilities for your team. So becoming not just the skill players of writing, creating, producing content, but to actually harnessing the ability to guide the entire organization, whether it's employees, executives, managers, customer service, whoever it is, to be good at creating all the content that will be in a consistent voice and a consistent story.
I love that idea. And especially as we've talked a lot about a content team becoming like short order cooks and not being involved in that bigger strategy. And I think becoming a content director sounds like a great place to go. But that's quite a shift. The other thing is that some content teams, they like the creation part of it, don't they? So have you found resistance where people are like, well, I quite like doing it, I don't, and but they'd rather write than they would edit, or they would rather, you know, or produce.
Well, 100%, yeah, this is true. Yeah, right. I mean, there are many content teams where either the skill is lacking.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, this is what, you know, we need to increase our ability to do things like managing, you know, this is, I mean, and you think about it, it's the classic, you know, actor who wants to direct,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yes, they might be an amazing actor, but they might not be a great director.
Yeah.
And that role is very different.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you've got to have a much bigger vision and a much better approach to managing all these disparate talent sources and letting them, by the way, express their talent in a way that you don't have.
Yeah.
And being able to, it's just a much different skill set. Yeah. And so there's absence of the skill set. And then to your point, there's also, I might have the skill set, but I have zero desire to do it. Right. You know, I'm a great writer and I like writing and I like being in my little cave and just, you know, give me words to write and that's all I want to do. And so the question then for the business becomes, do you either add that as a net new resource to the content team because it really needs to be done, or do you expand the remit of the existing content team to include these things?
I've seen the whole gamut of, you know, the whole extreme of these things, and I've certainly worked with some folks that want to be left in their hole with their typewriter and just create content. But it is quite a shift, isn't it? And the other shift, of course, is to get the business trained to write and to feel that way. I mean, I worked for a German software company. It was really hard to get a culture of sharing on the blog because that wasn't, you know, their engineers and stuff. And they were like, well, I don't have a PhD. I can't write. And I'm just like, no, we just want your opinion on this. And I found that there's that culture change as well, isn't it? So you're not only changing the culture of marketing and the content team, you've got to change the culture of the business too.
Well, that's it, yeah, right? Because yeah. it's a different operating model for sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's definitely a different operating model, and it's empowering that team to become a director too. I mean, this is where one of the biggest traps is that you expect the team, the content team, to do that, but you don't give them the power to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they end up sort of trying to throw their weight around and say, now this is good content, this is bad content, this is, you know, this is the way it should all come together. And basically the individual teams, whether it be sales or customer service or any part of the business, goes, I'm not listening to you. I'm doing my own thing. we don't need you. Right. And that's the worst of all possible worlds, because now you start having content going out from all those people. You know, this is sort of the inevitability of it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is those salespeople, they may start just creating their own stuff.
Yeah.
And boy, is that a dangerous thing.
Well, And this analogy of yours of being the director, I love this. And I'm now thinking about, the difference here is if you're the director of content, you have a strategy, you have the story arc, you have the whole film in your mind for the whole year, right? Rather than just randomly creating scenes on demand, as it were. I don't know if that's, I'm stretching this analogy in the wrong way.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
That and I think then if you've got your content strategy and you've got your topics, then you can go to your subject matter experts and give them a frame, can't you? And say we need some content on this. We're not going to do that content. You're going to do that content, but here's a brief. Here's a frame in which you can, if you can work, and we need it by, April 7th or something, right? That's the sort of directorship we're talking about, aren't we?
That's a great point. It's a great point, which is that, and that's where that different skill set comes in mind, right? Because you've got to have somebody who's capable of being able to frame those things up and to your other point, willing to frame those things up for all those different people and helping them, because the danger is that, yes, some of those employees, whether they be sales or otherwise, might be fantastic at expressing content, but they too may be either unwilling or unable to actually do that. So giving them the tools either helps them be better if they're already good at it and helps them be consistent with the story that's being told elsewhere.
Yeah.
Or if they're unable, like they're, then you're helping them at least give them a stool to stand on.
Yeah.
And if they're unwilling, well, then that's a whole different problem. But you're basically needing to encourage them that basically this is easy. I'm just giving you some content that I want you to share on LinkedIn or share to your network, or if you feel like making a video, this is the way to do it, right?
Yeah. No, I love this. So where will people find content that has been completely curated by every member of the team? I'm terrible.
Yeah, the giant team that is TCA, which is myself and my friend Kathy, basically, you'll find that at contentadvisory.net.
Splendid. And when people spin the dial on the interwebs and they're looking for you, where are they going to find you?
They're going to find me at a couple of places. Mm-hmm. One is I would point to our lovely little podcast called This Old Marketing, which you can go subscribe to your favorite podcatcher through at thisoldmarketing.com. Mm-hmm. And of course, our YouTube. We are on YouTube now as a YouTube show, so lovely to go there. And we've been spending a lot more time on YouTube. So if you go to youtube.com/@thisoldmarketing, you'll get to our YouTube channel.
Yeah, and you've got all the shorts and all the things there, haven't you?
It's fun. It's fun.
You're really into that.
Yeah, the TikTok. We got TikTok going.
Wow.
We got the whole thing.
Splendid. And will you be in the bar next week?
Oh, indeed.
I look forward to it, mate. I'll see you then. Thank you, Robert. Bringing a bit of Hollywood there to content operations and encouraging us all to have a director. I love that thought. So that's a wrap on episode 212 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. Thanks to Jeff and Robert for sharing their insights. You can find links to them, their work, and all the things we discussed in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog, newsletter, and all of our previous episodes. And thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. I'd love to hear from you, so please say hello or drop us a rating or review in your favourite podcast app, or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here.
Next week, we will continue our chat about content operations as I have Kathy McKnight back on the show, who regular listeners will know as the partner in crime of Mr. Robert Rose at the Content Advisory, who will also be back in the virtual bar with a fresh marketing thought. Till then, have a great week, and I'll hope you again join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.